Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who is walking her own path and who has agreed to share her path with us. Today is absolutely no different. I am very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Starita Boyce Ansari. Dr. Boyce Ansari, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Dr. Ansari, you have been described as a champion for social justice, as someone who is dedicated and committed to providing equal access to healthcare, education, and economic opportunity in the hopes of improving the lives of many. I'd like to step back just a moment and ask you to sort of share with us what your early experiences were like as a little one growing up. Who were some of your role models? Talk to us about that.
That's a perfect question. My role models are the members of my family. My grandfather founded the first Black credit union in Brooklyn, New York, Paragon. And my grandmother was one of the women demonstrating in front of Downstate Hospital for equal pay for women. So I will start there. And my kitchen table conversations with my parents in terms of what the world is like and how we need to make it a better place for all. And seeing Shirley Chisholm playing the keno in the dining room table, and I'm told that I have to go to bed. So I grew up in a social justice family, and I have no choice. And my son has no choice.
It sounds like you grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
All right. Paragon, that's a familiar name, a familiar part of history, an important part of our history. You grew up and you had no choice. What was the impact for you of Shirley Chisholm? And just for those in the audience who may not be familiar with her name, who was she and how did she impact your life?
I was not aware at the time that Mom and Dad were helping her with her election. I learned that later. I knew that my parents were very active and involved in the community in terms of social justice work and educational equity. My parents always believed that education is the key to emancipation. As a matter of fact, my grandfather told me, they can never take what's in your mind from you. And the best weapon to have is education. And the more degrees you have, the better you'll be. And that's maybe why I have a PhD.
That's a good reason.
Yes. And I did not, at that time, I did not know what they were doing. But there were lots of political meetings at my home for anyone who was running for any office. I remember Jewish men coming to the house, having to present about their platform. That was my house growing up.
So clearly being a part of the political environment, having access to the political environment, having a right to have access, that sounds like it was all very much a part of your early experiences, even if you didn't know what you were learning at the time.
Correct. Correct. Education and politics, that's what I saw growing up.
Interesting. So the idea of engaging not just in listening and agreeing to what you heard, but really engaging in critical thinking, again, sounds like it was a part of your history from very early on.
Yes, the books that I had were extensive, and my parents, they still have an extensive Black history library. And those books, the way I was raised, my core values, what's important in life. And I was raised, and this is how we raise our son now. You pick your friends not by the color of their skin or what they do or do not have economically. You pick them based upon their hearts.
Their heart, their character, who they are as individuals.
Yes. Yes. I mean, our wedding, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, but one thing we all have in common is our commitment for respect and dignity for all and being on the battlefield for that.
As you grew up and grew outside of your parents' immediate environment, moved into your own world, living your own life, what were some of the early things that you did?
I have to chuckle because I remember when I was in fifth grade, Mom and Dad being brought to school, not because they had bad grades, but I refused to salute the flag.
Oh, you did start early.
Yes. And so I had to salute the flag until I got out of school because my parents told me that the pen is a very powerful weapon and just do what you have to do until you get out. So,
What did you think about that as a fifth grader? I mean, you were making a statement and your parents told you not to make it in that way.
Because I knew my parents had my back, and I knew that Mom and Dad, they were on the battlefield for me. Therefore, whatever Mr. Bozanski put on my report card in the comment section was removed.
Ah. And you remember his name.
Yes, I remember his name. I think knowing that my parents were fighting for me made it easier for me to follow the rules as a child, that's the battle that they're going to pick up. You do your part, but we know the microaggressions that happen in education. They still happen today in education.
When you speak about microaggressions today, what are you referring to, and can you give us some examples?
The school that my son used to attend, they brought us in, and we said to ourselves, this is kind of early for a parents-teachers conference. The teachers spent the time interviewing us until I got tired of it. My patience was wearing thin, and I had asked them, what does our living or have to do with our son? And they tried to brush it off, and then that came to an end. And then one of the questions that they asked of us is whether or not he was in a habit of lying. And we had asked why. And they said, well, he said during the summer he had flight lessons and that he owns a home. And I responded, yes, he had flight lessons. My girlfriend owns a plane. And yes, he owns a home. Microaggressions like that go on in the classroom. Or when you have brilliant children, and particularly if it's a black boy and he raises his hands too often, he has attention deficit disorder. And he doesn't get placed in gifted and talented. That's what I mean by the microaggressions in education.
Speaking of your son, you wrote a letter to your son a bit ago, and you began it with, Dear Black Prince. What occasion, what occasioned that letter?
I always wanted to be a mom of a black male. Because I know it's so, so hard. But I didn't know it was going to be this hard. And did not know it was going to be this difficult during these times. I thought it would get better. And I wrote the letter for all black males to know how brilliant and bold and beautiful they are. And that the walk may not be easy, but they too must take the walk the same way Langston Hughes took the walk, Dr. King and Malcolm X took the walk. Because it is going to get better, and we have to learn how to make America better. But the challenge that we have as a nation is when we took social emotional learning out of the curriculum, when we took civics out of the curriculum, we then took the power away from the citizen to mobilize in their communities and to understand how the process works so we can get better quality educational systems and health systems in our communities. And I wrote that letter because no one is teaching that to our children. And somehow we have to stop racing to the top and focusing just on academics, but really focus on the human element, making our children more empathetic. Reports are coming out about the quote-unquote Trump effect in the classrooms. It's more bullying and more isms. We don't want our babies like that. That's not how we want our children to be. And yes, I wrote that 4 years ago because I saw what was coming down the pipeline. And now we're in a crisis. And we have to bring everyone together. We cannot continue down this road of operating in a silo. Our children have to learn to build relationships with someone based upon their heart, not their religion, not their country of origin. They have to learn to respect themselves and others. But more importantly, they have to learn to be responsible, give back, be philanthropic, like how we were philanthropic. Our parents and our grandparents were philanthropic for the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. Philanthropy was defined as time, talent, and treasures. It wasn't defined by how much I can get for a tax write-off. We lost our way. That's not what was at my dining room table. That's not how my mother and father, Shirley Chisholm, that's not how they were speaking. They were talking about the good for all in New York. Not just for some, but for everyone. And we have to get back to that. And so writing that is for Blake and everyone else from age 6 on up to really take stock and for the families to take stock of how we are raising our children.
I'm looking at a copy of the letter, and early on in your dialogue with your black prince, you wrote, "Life is no crystal stair for blacks in America, but we continue to climb and turn corners. Sometimes we climb in darkness, but even then we don't turn back and we don't sit down. We keep climbing."
It's funny you talk about that because this morning I said, what am I going to tell my son? And I took out Langston Hughes' poem and I recited it to him. And I forgot that I had that poem in the letter.
We don't sit down, we keep climbing.
You have to keep climbing. You don't sit down, you have to keep climbing. It's like the spiritual, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. That's where we are. And that's my message to everyone this morning. We have to heal as a nation. We're going to have to help our schools since the teachers are concerned about the hate that they see in the classroom and the bullying and the aggression. We have to look out for our children, all of our children.
Because
we cannot be a selfish country.
And in some ways, there seems to be support. There seems to be a celebration of being a selfish country.
Yes. There's a celebration of being a selfish country. But, and this goes back to about the civics part, if children can learn that Asians built the railroads, if they can learn that blacks built the White House, if they can learn that everyone came here and did something to build this nation, we all played a part, and we all must continue to play a part, then maybe we'll have more empathy, and maybe we'll have more respect for one another. That is what I'm hoping for.
Dr. Starita Boyce Ansari, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue this conversation. Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back. Starita, you talked a moment ago about philanthropy, and I mean, quite frankly, many people in this United States, when they think about philanthropy, they don't think about persons of color. They think about wealthy organizations, wealthy individuals. Wealthy white individuals is often what is connected to the work of supporting other people and other organizations. It sounds like from your early experiences, philanthropy was just very much a part of your life, even as you were sitting around the kitchen table or observing the grown-ups sitting around the kitchen table.
Yes, philanthropy in the United States has a different meaning than other countries. Most nations ascribe to the donation of your time, talent, and treasures. And you're right, the image is wealthy white males. But I think about my father-in-law and the work that he did for voters' rights and starting NAACP chapters. That's philanthropy. He donated his time, talent, and treasures for you and I to have the right to vote. That's philanthropy. Other countries, that's the definition that they use. It's more than having your name on a building. And think about it. Philanthropy is about you giving of yourself for others. It's not something that's selfish. It's altruism. And we should return to that. I would like to see an opportunity for our schools to return to civic engagement. What we have now in the school system is students volunteering, doing service learning, but they're not doing it out of their hearts. They're doing it because it'll look good on their resume for college. That's not philanthropy.
Okay.
And when you talk to educators about this, they say they can't. They don't have time to talk about the environment or time to talk about poverty or any of the social issues because they're focused on test scores. And when we do the service learning, very often it's a project where you have to go into a low-income black or brown community. And so then it gives the image to all children that black and brown people are not philanthropic. And we have to correct that definition. And once again, if we were to teach civics and social responsibility in the classroom, then our children will learn that everyone can be a philanthropist, and all walks of life have been philanthropic. And the best way to do that is through a giving circle. Let the children learn about their communities, where the needs are, decide where they want to make an impact, and come together and make that impact. Because it may not necessarily be going to a neighborhood of color where the children want to do best. It may be their interest is in aging, because a significant number of the children have grandparents who have Alzheimer's, and so that's what they want to do. So the lens that we have in this country about who needs and who doesn't need and who has and who doesn't have has an impact on the definition and on the work that we do. I agree.
You were an important part of the W.K. Kellogg Build Bridges research team and traveled to and studied philanthropy in Argentina. And I understand that you also advised Chinese and Latino philanthropists on international philanthropy. What did those experiences teach you? How did they inform your work moving forward?
Argentina was a tough one for me, in the sense of seeing poverty to the extent of people who are actually sleeping in cardboard boxes. And we were there for research, and my fellow scholars were thinking about publications in terms of global philanthropy. And I could not, my heart would not allow my mind to function to the extent that 2 days that I was there, I refused to eat because of the poverty that I saw. Mm. And for me, coming back to the United States and the work that I was doing, it empowered me even further in terms of what needs to happen in response to global poverty. And my lens switched in terms of my career, in terms of my focus. From that point on, my concentration has been on issues of inequity, whether it's health inequity, educational inequities. My lens is inequity because of that trip. And I've had clients who are in the United States, but they want to be philanthropic back home, and back home may be China, Barbados, and have helped them create a fund so they can support a cause in their nation. But the work that I do is social justice philanthropy.
You mentioned a moment ago giving circles. What precisely is a giving circle?
Is where people come together and they decide which causes that they want to respond. And they have a mission statement, and they study the community, and they decide which nonprofits to whom they are going to support. And they support those nonprofits repeatedly. And that's how you have your greatest impact, versus writing, making a $10,000 donation this year to an organization that serves children that is located on I Street, and then next year you make a donation of $10,000 to another organization that serves children, but they're located on K Street. That doesn't bring impact. You have to have sustainable giving repeatedly so organizations can grow. And then your giving is unrestricted, allowing the executive director to use your money to the way he or she knows is best to have the greatest impact. What I like about giving circles is that they are very empowering. You know, most of us, our last names are not Ford or Rockefeller. So therefore, we don't sit on the board of Ford or Rockefeller and make the decisions about where the money is going to go. So a giving circle, you're in the community, and you know the needs of the community, and then you award grants to that organization to keep them, to support the work that they are doing. And that's the beauty of it. It's very empowering, and not only for the donor, but also for the community and for the nonprofit.
And I noticed that you said that the funds are often unrestricted. And I think about today's landscape where there seems to be a demand for a specific accounting of each dollar and what's going to be the specific benefit of that dollar in that area versus unrestricted funds. And so I think perhaps what has always been true is that people tend to create things to the funds, just as teachers are taught to teach to the test. And I don't know, what's your thought about that?
No, that is correct. What happens, and let me say, it doesn't happen to all organizations. Our small community-based organizations very often are put in a box, and the money must, and the foundation will send or RFP saying ABCD thing, and then our executive directors, they have to do various yoga positions with their organization in order to get the money. And I don't support that. You can still have accountability. You give $10,000 of unrestricted money. The executive director is going to tell you, we're going to use this money for ABCD thing. And then you do your assessment afterwards. That person is in the community doing the work. Trust their expertise that they know how best to serve the community. And you're correct, those days are over for a lot of organizations, a lot of middle-sized and small-sized organizations. The larger organizations, they are able to come to the table, have a conversation with a program officer, and they put their heads together and they talk about what needs to happen, and the relationship is made. But very often, our smaller community-based organizations, they don't have that access because they don't have the board members that have the relationships with the program officers at the foundations.
So how do you deal with that if you're a small organization? And by the way, you mentioned RFP, meaning a request for proposal?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. How do the smaller for somebody who's listening right now, who perhaps may be in the process of considering building an organization or is actually has begun a small entity, what's their path?
Your board. And having a board matrix where you have committees such as your public relations committee, your fundraising committee, governance, various committees, and the number of people that you need to sit on each of those committees, and realizing if the in my opinion, the best model is a model that realizes that the board is responsible for a significant percentage of the operational costs, because funders are not going to pay for the salary of the CEO or the executive director. And the world has moved to a point where they have to see that the board is willing to cover some of those expenses. And then funders feel they are in partnership with the organization, and they can put X percentage, meaning the funder. The funder then can direct X percentage of their money towards the program side of the work, which will be a larger percentage, and then a smaller percentage towards the salaries or the operational expenses.
There's a path, but you have to have, it sounds like, a working board.
You have to have a working board, a board that, so here's my recommendation. And when my clients come to me, and I honestly understand, they say we're a community organization, and I'm not saying that you're going to lose your status of a community organization and the heritage of the work that you do by bringing people on board that are employed at corporations. Or, as an example, last week I had a meeting talking with the board about the importance of, this is a health organization, about the importance of them bringing people on board who work at pharmaceutical corporations or who are in senior level management at hospitals. And that was very hard for them. And the message that I'm saying is that if you have someone who works at a corporation, that person writes a check for $10,000 to your organization, more than likely, that pharmaceutical company has a matching gift program. So now you have that individual has now just become a $20,000 donor that can help meet operational expenses. Same thing with the medical profession. You then have someone who has access to local officials that can help you along the way, because when people read your list of board members and you are a community-based health nonprofit, small community-based health nonprofit, and then they see, oh my goodness, you have a person who is part of University of Pennsylvania Health System on your board, that opens doors for you to be, and that person can talk with people about what may be available to you. So then you're using your board members not so much for the wealth that they can bring financially, but also the wealth that they can bring in terms of relationships and opening doors for you. And that's what I do. I try to get our organizations to understand that.
And I would suggest that in many ways, the wealth that comes with the creation and growth of relationships may in fact have a greater impact than the initial $10,000 or $20,000 or $1,000 donation.
Correct. So let's talk about the recession and which nonprofits survived and which ones did not. The ones that did not survive were the ones that did not have a diverse board, because foundations said our endowments are not giving us the return that we used to have. And they selected which organizations that they were going to carry through the crisis. So if you were not selected, you lost that money.
And you may not have survived.
Right. So how are you going to survive? So if your portfolio is 100% government funding, that means you cannot serve your community the way you want to. You're actually serving the government based on what the government tells you needs to be done. But if your portfolio is foundation and government, you had a little better chance of surviving. But if your portfolio is one-third individual, one-third government, and one-third foundation, you survived. Because the individuals, they were making certain the light stayed on. And that's responsive philanthropy. And that's where I am trying to move our organizations, to responsive philanthropy versus having to beg for money from the government. You can't move the social justice agenda if you have to beg for money from the government.
Well, that's very true. Dr. Starita Boyce-Ansari, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue this important conversation. Don't go away, folks. Dorita, you have said that we have to come together to take on the true heart of today's inequality, which is economic injustice. Can you say more about that thought?
One of the things that is troubling to me, and I may offend some of your listeners, but it's something that I have done. I used to tithe my 10% to the church, and I stopped. I still tithe 10%, but not all of it goes towards the church, because my mind now is towards investing where I can to move the agenda. And education and economics go side by side. If our schools are failing our children, and they are failing our children, over 50% of black men who attend public schools do not earn a high school diploma, and then they end up going to jail because they're selling illegal products to earn a living, and then we go down this policing for profit and Black Lives Matters and the economics and the police shootings, and it's a vicious cycle as it relates to not providing the quality of education in our communities so there can be economic empowerment. And if your place of worship, whether it's a mosque, a temple, or a synagogue, is not responding to the economic needs of communities, my position is that we have to invest where it's best for our children. And that's what I've done. I'm fortunate that where I do worship, that it is a social justice place. But I'd no longer feel guilty if I, 1 year I give 6% and the other year I give 4% someplace else. But when I talk about economic empowerment, it for me is two things. One is being able to take your philanthropic dollars and feeling free enough to put them where you know where change is going to be. And the other part is being very aware of what systems are in place that prevent economic empowerment. What systems are in place that fund the cradle-to-prison pipeline, and so therefore you should not be purchasing products from those institutions. Take the time and do the research and learn what is happening. Learn about the privatization of the prison system and the impact it has on your community. Pay attention to what's going on in the schools and be involved in your community. Vote for who's going to be on the school board and the community board. Donate your time, talent, and treasures there, because education and economics are linked to one another.
You have been talking, using the term social justice throughout our conversation today. I would just like for you to state what specifically you mean by social justice. And the reason that I'm asking you to state it again is because, you know, we know that, or let me say that I am aware that there are many people who hear social justice and think that's for those poor Black and brown people who don't want to go to work, and that's this kind of liberal craziness. There are people who believe that with every fiber of their being. So, again, what does social justice mean to you?
There are 10 areas. So, 10 areas in which there are inequities: aging, disabilities, environment, health, mental health, LGBTQ, race, poverty, religion, and women. Each of those has a justice argument, something in terms of making the scales balance.
Clearly, with that list, you're making it clear that this is about all people, potentially all people in all areas, communities, walks, stages in life.
And that's what I'm saying, and that goes back to when we were talking earlier about giving circles being able to empower and respond, and the importance of bringing socio-emotional learning back into the classroom so a child can understand elder rights, a child can understand environmental justice, a child can understand food deserts in low-income communities, a child can understand mental health. We are just interested in passing test scores. And here's my argument. Okay, Jason, You have scored 99 on all your exams. Okay, Sarah, you are an A-plus student. But what kind of leaders are we preparing? What kind of managers are they going to be if they are not sensitive to the human condition of their fellow man? We have lost our way. And this morning, I woke up and I realized how far we are as a nation.
How far we have to go, how far we have fallen, how far we have gone.
Hey, we have how far we have fallen off the track. I reflect upon Lyndon B. Johnson signing those documents. What happened?
You said,
how do we become a nation that is fearful of someone else because I don't worship the way you worship? I don't sleep the way you sleep. I don't eat what you eat. How did that happen?
It sounds like in significant ways we are shrinking as a nation rather than expanding.
Yes, our capacity to love one another is shrinking. Our capacity to respect one another is shrinking. And now our educators are calling for help because they see it in the classroom. They see the microaggressions in the classroom, the bullying, the isolation on the playground. Oh, I'm not playing with you because you don't have a doorman when I come to visit you. Or I'm not playing because you don't look like me.
And so much of that they get from family. And it sounds like what you're advocating in paying attention to the children become the teachers of the adults in some significant ways.
That's what I said. Remember, I said we had to bring the classroom into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we have to do. We have to bring the classroom into the kitchen. Our children are going to have to teach their parents to be empathetic and caring. And there's more to life than whether or not your child gets an A on the exam. We were talking about philanthropy and humanitarianism.
You know, as you say, there's perhaps more to life than your child getting an A on the exam. And I think about so many parents who, even before their child is born, they're putting them on the list for that perfect school so they have those perfect contacts so they can get that perfect spouse and that perfect job.
Yeah, I have friends who do the same. We did not raise Blake that way. We had raised him to be a kind and gentle spirit in terms of the book that we provided him and in terms of making certain he had a diverse play group.
There are those who would say that diversity just doesn't work. And it's clearly not working in this country in a lot of ways. And what they need to do is to really protect their child, to insulate their child from the racism, the sexism, all the isms that abound. And they don't particularly want to have their child in a diverse environment, don't want themselves to be in a diverse environment, feeling it's not particularly safe, physically safe as well as emotionally and socially safe. What do you say to those folks?
I, in some ways, understand that. Let me say this. The school that I spoke about, Blake started off being in a very diverse class, and then the school became less diverse. And my husband and I did not want him to be the only black male in the classroom. And he And this is a quote-unquote progressive school. And he ends up being the only black male. But the questions of the teachers made it clear to my husband and to me that this was not the right place for him. What I strongly believe is that it's difficult raising a black boy in America. I correct myself. What I know, not what I believe, what I know. Currently, he goes to a school founded by a Motown executive. It's an all-boys school for the brightest black and brown boys they are. And they are raising those boys to be leaders. And it's the best thing that could have ever happened to him. Somewhere like the Jewish schools, where they raise them to be strong in their faith and proud of who they are. So you have to strike a balance. And I think it's important that if you cannot get that balance at home, and you cannot get that balance in school, then it's your duty as a parent to find a way to get that balance either in the community or in your place of worship. Because children, regardless whether they're Asian, black, Latino, they have to have self-confidence and know that I am somebody in order for them to be productive citizens. So at the end of the day, whatever it takes for your sugar plum dumpling to know that he or she is somebody, you do it. And it may mean you have to take him or her out of that private school in order for to ensure that. And it may mean the public school that you're in, you're going to have to become very active in the parent association and with your local officials to make certain that he or she gets what he needs. Because empathy and mental health is very important to being a successful adult. And I will take that any day over an A. I will take a B student who's a good person, who has strong character, and is going to do right by this nation over a child with an A who, because of the microaggressions, is depressed and commits suicide.
I would suggest that your son, Blake, is quite gifted in the parents that he has.
You can thank
quote
you.
Me. You can quote thank, me.
thank you. He is America's youngest philanthropist. At the age of 6, donating libraries to homeless children. And Nori and I are beginning to see the return on investment by teaching him to pick his friends based upon their hearts. And in saying that, the same friends he has had from pre-K, he has now, and he's in 5th grade, based upon their hearts.
I do wish that so many more of us, all of us, approached our everyday lives from that perspective, that your choices are based on perhaps what is really important, which is their hearts and their character. Dr. Boyce Ansari, you are the President and Chief Change Officer of MSB Philanthropy Advisors. Tell us briefly, if you can, about your organization.
We help people make decisions about their philanthropic interests, and we do board development, strategic planning. And we currently have a model called the 3 R's, which is respect, relationships, and responsibility, which is an after-school curriculum that brings empathy in the school, introduce children to philanthropists, allows children to have the opportunity to talk about environmental justice, whether or not they're concerned about it or not, and convince the other six-year-old why it is something to be concerned about, and then at the end of it all, put their time, talents, and treasures towards a cause and make a gift towards that.
Sounds like you're also saying that there's no such thing as not being able to give something of yourself at any age, at every age.
Correct. And we're moving towards more of a focus of youth philanthropy and also board development for community-based organizations.
Is there a website or a way for listeners to be in touch with you if they would like to do so?
The website is msbphilanthropyadvisors.com. The email is msbphilanthropy@verizon.net.
Okay.
And if they want to call, it's 646-285-1068.
All right, so there are lots of ways to be in touch and to continue the conversation.
Yes.
Dr. Starita Boyce Ansari, thank you very much for your time today and the work that you do and the work that you're doing with children and with your son. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and enjoy your day.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.